www.thebookbarn.com. Again, I'm also on Facebook, and look out for the second edition.
All right. Thank you so much again for joining us on Flip the Script.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So, again, thank you to Crecia Esquivel for joining us. Thank you to Federico Garcia for being in the back holding down, taking calls. Thank you to our caller, Susan, in the South Bay, and, of course, Crecia's family, which is out here holding down for us. Special thanks to Saba Wahid, as well as Riku Matsuda. Stay tuned for Indie Media coming up next.
A man child would be born. Boldest crazy circumstance. I knew his life deserved a chance.
Hi, I'm Rita Gonzalez.
And I'm Ralph Radaboff. This week on The Out Agenda, our guest is Amanda Wallner from the LA LGBT Center. She will be telling us about a Women's Health Conference 360 taking place on Saturday, April 16th.
To learn more, just log on to archive.kpfk.org, then click on to The Out Agenda.
Hi, this is John Crumshaw, host of Politics or Pedagogy. On KPFK, you hear more than a soundbite. That's education. That's our mission. Pledge online today at kpfk.org, and thank you for being a KPFK listener.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal from Imprison Nation. You're listening to listener-sponsored KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. KPFK, powered by the people.
From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, California, this is Indie Media on air on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Chris Burnett. All right, welcome to the show tonight. Javier Cethnas is going to be my guest. And Javier, or let's start off with, okay, Herbert Marcuse was a critical theorist, an anti-authoritarian, a member of the Frankfurt School, a lifelong revolutionary, and an inspiration to the New Left, a professor, and many, many other titles that one could use to describe this philosopher and radical. Marcuse was called the father of the New Left, a term he rejected because of its implied patriarchy, but did, of course, have a profound impact on the generation of the 60s and 70s. My guest tonight is Javier Cethnas, author of a forthcoming book entitled Eros and Revolution, The Critical Philosophy of Herbert Marcuse. Javier is also the author of For a Free Nature, Critical Theory, Social Ecology, and Post-Developmentalism, and he has essays and articles published in a number of radical publications. He is a member of the Black Rose Anarchist Federation. Javier, welcome to the show.
Thank you very kindly, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back and talking about your new book about Herbert Marcuse. And just to start off at the top, I'm very happy that you wrote this book. I was a student at UCSD, but many, many years after Marcuse was had passed away but had taught there, and I had met a number of students of his who were very deeply inspired by his work and had moved on in life to do very amazing things, were radicals, doing many different projects, but always talked highly of Marcuse. And and you know, had some very interesting stories about him, which maybe we can bring up later. So I'm very glad that you wrote this book, and maybe we could just start off for our listeners giving a sort of an overview of who he was.
Of course. Well, Herbert Marcuse, you know, born 1898 in Berlin, died in 1979 in Starnberg, West Germany. He was one of the most famous critical theorists of the 20th century, self-described Marxist, an anti-authoritarian, critical theorist, very interested in the thought of, obviously, of Marx, of Hegel, of Charles Fourier, utopian socialism. He melded romanticism together with utopian socialism, and was also later, you know, became more interested in the ideas of Sigmund Freud in terms of metapsychology, in terms of social psychology, in terms of the destructive tendencies that we see on exhibit in capitalist society. And, you know, personally, he was he fought in World War One. Well, not fought, but he participated in the German Revolution at the end of World War One, and fought to defend that from the reactionary Freikorps who murdered Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht on the orders of the Social Democrat Party, and thereafter, you know, became involved with the Frankfurt School, had to flee Germany just before Hitler came to power, you know, after that he served with the U.S. government to fight the fascist war effort in the OSS, or the Office Force, which is the precursor of the CIA, although there was a lot of distinction between the OSS and the CIA. And then later, you know, he went on, he became most famous in the 1960s when he became sort of the quote-unquote prophet of revolution on the world stage. He spoke to students in Berlin. He was present in Paris at the May 1968 upheavals. He was a, you know, relentless critic of the genocidal Vietnam War, and a great, actual staunch defender of Angela Davis when she was being persecuted by the state. And, you know, he received a lot of death threats for this, and he lost his job at UCSD because of the machinations of Ronald Reagan, the new governor in the late 60s. And then later in the 70s, you know, he continued analyzing capitalist society, continued analyzing the destabilization of capitalist society that we saw in the 1970s with inflation, with increased class struggle. And, you know, through his entire life, he was a very consistent anti-fascist, anti-authoritarian, dialectical thinker, and not only thinker, but a true activist.
Yeah, your book is full of just some amazing analysis of his politics, and I'd like to just quote you, and then we can maybe talk a little bit about this. One speculative hypothesis regarding the factors of which impelled the libertarian revolutionism, the essential anarchism of the members of the Frankfurt School, is that the negations experienced by Marcuse and other Frankfurtians in the face of the Nazi takeover of their native Germany and the attendant necessity of their flight and exile accentuated the highly critical views they already had held of social democracy, liberalism, and bourgeois society. Practically all of the Frankfurters felt that these three factors to have collaborated in giving birth to outright fascism, as Marcuse argues in his bold 1928 essay on the struggle against liberalism in the totalitarian view of the state. And the reason I quoted that, because it touches upon liberalism and the rise of Nazism and also the Frankfurt School. So maybe you could put us in that time period and tell us what he's writing about.
Of course. Well, you know, this is a fascinating debate, and in fact, it, you know, it resonates even through to our own day today, and perhaps we can talk about that later. But, you know, the Frankfurt School had a very anti-authoritarian analysis of Nazism and of fascism, you know, and they were clearly so traumatized by this experience, being in the majority German Jews, being Marxists. Essentially what they did in exile when they were in New York City is that they tried to understand how it is that fascism or Nazism came about in their native Germany. And essentially what they concluded was that capitalist society, liberal society, bourgeois society gives rise to fascism. And this is an analysis very similar to that you see by Daniel Guérin in Fascism and Big Business, essentially that the irrationality of capitalism inevitably gives rise to the contradictory revolutionary movement that impels its negation. However, given this threat, the capitalists choose dictatorship, tyranny, and outright totalitarianism in order to defend their privileges, in order to defend society as it exists. So in that essay that you mentioned, you know, Marcuse discusses how liberalism fetishizes the corporate executive, the CEO, the business owner, and it basically, you know, it's okay with suspending civil liberties, it's okay with declaring the state of emergency when the proletariat threatens to overthrow existing society. So, you know, for Marcuse, it was not a huge gap between capitalism and fascism. And Horkheimer made a very nice, one of his comrades in the Frankfurt School, Max Horkheimer, the director, made a very, you know, telling statement once, and he said that those who do not want to speak badly of capitalism should say nothing of fascism.
Well, you know, just hearing you talk about this, you can't help but think about what's happening today in the United States and, you know, sort of neoliberalism and its destruction of the working class in the United States, its privatization of everything that has to do with the commons or the public sphere. And, you know, we see the murmurings of, you know, sort of what people have referred to as a neo-fascism in Trump and some of its supporters, at least making comparisons to the rhetoric of Mussolini. I mean, it's almost deja vu when I'm reading this stuff.
Indeed. And, you know, not only Daniel Garan in the book I cited a few minutes ago, but also Hannah Arendt in The Origins of Totalitarianism. I mean, I don't really talk about this in the book, but, you know, it's very much pervading it. That is that, you know, her analysis was that Hitlerism was very much inspired by the genocide of the Native Americans, colonialism in Africa, you know, especially the genocide of the Armenians when Hitler invaded Poland. You know, very famously he said to his colleagues, he said, "Who now remembers the genocide of the Armenians?"
Mm. Well, Marcuse was also a very vocal critic of the Vietnam War and U.S. imperialism. Can you tell us a little bit about this critique, and would you consider his book, One Dimensional Man, to be the foundation of that critique?
So, of course, I mean, Marcuse was a great defender of the Vietnamese resistance, and not only that, but also the Cuban Revolution. He lost his job at Brandeis, that was his first professorship, for outright supporting the Cuban Revolution and speaking at a student rally, you know, criticizing Kennedy's approach, Kennedy's attempted invasion and overthrow of Castro's regime. So he was, you know, he suffered for that reason. In terms of Vietnam, you know, that came when he was more at UCSD after his time at Brandeis, and he received many death threats. I mean, you know, San Diego being a very reactionary city full of admirals, retired generals, you know, full of manufacturing for the military. And so he received death threats from the KKK for supporting the Vietnamese resistance and also for supporting Angela Davis. And, you know, actually it's quite interesting, quite amusing that while he was in Paris in May 1968, he was speaking on the 150th anniversary of Marx's birth at a UNESCO conference. He presented his presentation, and then actually just after that, you know, May 1968 happened a few days later, but just after he gave that speech, he kind of randomly had a very impromptu meeting with the Vietnamese peace delegation that was in Paris at the time negotiating, you know, trying to negotiate an end to the war at that time. But in terms of the connection with One Dimensional Man, I mean, One Dimensional Man, of course, is Marcuse's most pessimistic book. You know, it's an analysis of U.S. society, of monopoly capitalism, and it's an analysis of how, basically, in his idea, the proletariat had been integrated into capitalism in the United States. And it's important to stress that it was really only limited to the United States, as he clarified later. It didn't apply to Europe, France, Italy, other places where there was still a lot of class struggle, where there was a lot less affluence on hand. But, you know, One Dimensional Man, as I said, is very pessimistic, and it really it accentuates this pessimism, the lack of class struggle in U.S. society, You know, this was the age of the 1950s, you know, conformism, the baby boomers, etc. However, you know, that's Marcuse's most famous book, and everyone who knows Marcuse probably knows him for that volume. But it's important to note that actually Marcuse's analysis of One Dimensional Man was very temporary. Later in 1968, you know, he gave a speech beyond One Dimensional Man where he came to really question a lot of what he was saying in that book. And then the Essay on Liberation the next year was a very, very optimistic, very utopian, revolutionary analysis of where society was headed at the end of the 1960s. Thereafter, in the 1970s, in his last decade of life, you know, he fundamentally jettisoned the pessimistic hypotheses of one-dimensional man, given, you know, increasing trends in class struggle, in absenteeism, sabotage at the workplace in the United States. So in terms of the connection between the two, I don't really see one, because in One-Dimensional Man, you know, he really only dedicates a few pages to the possibility of breaking free of this monopoly capitalist iron cage, as Max Weber might put it. However, he does focus in those pages on the civil rights movement in particular. You know, he says that when the people in the South go out to demand the most basic rights, they know that they meet the dogs, you know, the gas, they even meet death. And he actually, you know, later he said that he dedicated One Dimensional Man to those revolutionary struggles. So I would say that his activist analysis of imperialism and his critique of that came elsewhere, you know, all of the rest of his works in life. But One Dimensional Man is not, I don't really see the connection.
Okay. Well, you talk about the social scientists and positivism in sort of mainstream academia and his rejection of that. And you've referred to his philosophy many times in the book and going into great depth. Can you explain what his... what negativity means when he talks about his analysis?
Of course. So, you know, positivism for Marcuse is this very reactionary liberal analysis of basically taking society as it is and saying that, you know, there's no possibility of going beyond it. So he analyzed Auguste Comte, the French sociologist, in these terms. He faced off with Karl Popper. You know, he criticized Karl Popper in an essay from the 1950s and had a face-to-face debate with him in the 1970s. And what Marcuse did is he associated positivism with the reaction to the Hegelian philosophy. And this comes most clearly in, I think, personally, in what I consider his best book, which is from 1941, Reason and Revolution, which is his very, very intense analysis of Hegel. And he actually wrote this with the reason of calling into question a false notion that a lot of Anglo-American academics had, which was that Hegel, you know, in his late support of the state, was a precursor of fascism. So basically what Marcuse does in this very lengthy and involved volume is he goes through Hegel's philosophy, and he shows how Hegel was very much influenced by the French Revolution, very much influenced by the idea of bringing about freedom, bringing about reason through the negation of existing society, as you see in the French Revolution. And toward the end of the book, well, I mean, he associates Hegel, or the young Hegel at least, I mean, the late Hegel, who was into dictatorship and Napoleon and all of that, you know, he says that that was a very inauthentic move at the end of his life. He associates the young Hegel with Marx, who continued his ideas, and then he also associates, he talks about the counter-revolutionary reaction to Hegel, which was, you know, basically to deny that, because a lot of, you know, the privileged aristocrats, the feudalists in Europe, they realized that this Hegelian philosophy was very dangerous. The idea that reason and freedom could be attained through the negation of existing society, through revolution. And so they came up with, you know, very proto-fascistic ideas about the necessity of obedience, you know, very Hobbesian notions that negated any place for natural law, for justice, for revolution, and so on. And actually, he concludes this Reason and Revolution by quoting Carl Schmitt, you know, Carl Schmitt being one of the prime Nazi legal theorists, who said that on January 20th, 1933, the day of Hitler's ascension, Hegel, so to say, died.
Well, it seems that, Unfortunately, we only have about 10 minutes left, and there's a number of the questions I want to get to, and there's so much depth in this book. I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Javier Cethnes, whose forthcoming book is entitled Eros and Revolution, The Critical Philosophy of Herbert Marcuse, and it's fantastic. Where will people be able to get this book?
So this book is coming out in June with Brill Publishers, which is an academic press. It will have a limited print. It's going to be quite expensive because Brill is, you know, academic, and it's going to be in hardcover. However, a year later, approximately in September of next year, there will be coming out the paperback edition, which will be much more reasonably priced, and that's coming out with Haymarket Press, Haymarket Books. And the book is actually the 86th title in the studies on critical social sciences in that series.
Okay. Well, we can talk more about it in the meantime, and the future shows. But let me ask you this. I'm thinking about what value Marcuse has today to the movements that are around us right now, and obviously the coming reaction to neoliberalism and the state and the nature of the climate crisis that we've discussed many times. There's so much, I think, that we could learn from Marcuse, and I want to quote you real quick and then ask you a question about it. You write, "For Marcuse, the libertarian element of revolutionism is essential, both as taken from Marx but also beyond him. In summer 1968, in an interview conducted on the French Riviera, Marcuse brashly declares that all attempts at revolution are worthless if they do not contain an element of adventurism. All the rest is organization, labor union, social democracy, the establishment. Adventure is always beyond." While Marx had an important influence on Marcuse as any other historical and philosophical figure, and though the critical theorist describes his own politics and life as Marxist, while, quote, romantic libertarian communist, unquote, might be a more precise formulation, Marcuse in his life work was very far from being a Marxist ideologue. Now, how would you characterize Marcuse's use of Marx in his work? For example, in Eros and Civilization, he doesn't quote Marx at all, and he seems to reject the mechanistic descriptions of the working class in terms of their role in revolution.
That's right, of course. And One Dimensional Man is one of the most famous expressions of that, right, where he questions the orthodox Marxist view that the proletariat will necessarily be the revolutionary subject that will bring about the destruction of capitalism. You know, he sees, and he actually uses Marx's famous letter to Engels, in which he says that the proletariat, or the working class, is revolutionary or it is nothing at all. And so he uses that, I think, primarily for his analysis in One Dimensional Man. But, I mean, in terms of, you know, romanticism, in terms of his political views, I think clearly he was a libertarian socialist. You know, we see this in Eros and Civilization, where he uses Freud to basically upend capitalist apologism, saying that, you know, this idea that we are necessarily destructive, necessarily given to repression and failure, that this is really which is what Freud said at a certain point, that this is actually only historically mediated. That is to say, that it's a reflection of capitalism. But we can, of course, go beyond capitalism, and we see this, in his interest in Hegel, in his interest in Charles Fourier, in Friedrich Schiller, utopian socialism. You know, I mean, he very much took greatly from Marx, and I think Marx was the number one source for him, but he took a lot else from other people. And in the May 1968 speech that I mentioned earlier in the interview, you know, he calls this the re-examination of the concept of revolution. And this, and again, it was given at the 150th anniversary of Marx's birth, where he actually presents a very strong critique of Marx. He says that, you know, Marx did not foresee genocide. He did not foresee the ruling class resorting to genocide and extreme militarism in terms of defending bourgeois society. He did not foresee the invidious use of propaganda and social psychology to tie the working class and the subordinated into existing society. And generally, of course, he does question this idea that at least the advanced proletariat, I mean, the proletariat in the quote-unquote advanced countries, United States in particular, will necessarily be the gravedigger of capitalism. For him, he was much more into the guerrilla warfare decolonization national liberation struggles, as I said, with Cuba, with Vietnam, and so on. So I think that certainly, you know, Marx was extremely important, but you know, actually in the 1967 summer lectures in Berlin, West Berlin, he explicitly says that we should look to Fourier rather than Marx because utopia is at hand in his analysis, and he thinks that this positivistic, you know, scientistic, mechanistic perspective of Marx is actually quite questionable.
And for today, what do you think how would young people organizing out on the streets today and going forward, how would Marcuse fit into the narratives that are being that we see and hear and the struggle for, you know, saving the earth essentially and ecology?
Well, that's a great. I'm really glad you asked that question. You know, because the last few chapters of the book, you know, I dedicate to thinking about Marcuse today, and I dedicate one chapter to Nature and Revolution, looking at his analysis of capitalism as a very destructive force of the ecology of animal life, of nature, and particularly focusing in on his 1965 essay on repressive tolerance, which is a very fascinating argument he makes there. What he says, and I've not really seen this, I mean, I've seen it sometimes with anarchists and things, but what he says essentially is that the left must withdraw support and tolerance for reactionaries, for people who advocate militarism, who advocate genocide, who advocate racism, who advocate sexism, and all of these very reactionary ideologies, that they must actually actively reject that. And that is, you know, and that's a similar idea that he developed around this time in the mid-1960s. You know, he has a very nice essay on Gracchus Babeuf, who was a revolutionary in the French Revolution who attempted an insurrection against the Directory, which had overthrown the Jacobins in the late on, you know, before Napoleon. But I think that, you know, I think that clearly his idea of the militant minority, whereby the left organizes radically through direct action, through counter-information, basically to show the utter depravity of capitalist society and where it's going with regard to the destruction of nature, with regard to the genocide of, you know, the Native Americans, of Vietnam, of so many other places, Palestine as well. You know, I mean, I think that there is so much that we can gain from Marcuse in terms of the dialectic of negation as against the affirmative stance of, you know, there's no problem here, capitalism is the best idea, you know, it's the pinnacle of history. No, I mean, Marcuse shows very clearly that that's false. And in this concluding chapter that I have, I also discuss feminism. You know, he was, late in life, he became a very strong feminist, and he developed this idea of feminist socialism, or feminine socialism, you know, in terms of direct action, in terms of overthrowing the male-dominating principle of patriarchy. And I also discuss, and I want to belabor the point, but, you know, in Reason and Revolution, he discusses the Hegelian point of the Weltgeist, or the world spirit, or as I translate it, the world mind. And for me, this really focuses in on the idea of a radical anarchist mass global movement that would put an end to the state, capitalism, militarism, and patriarchy.
Well, that's a good place to end it, and it's very well said. Javier Cethnas has been my guest, and his forthcoming book is called Eros and Revolution, The Critical Philosophy of Herbert Marcuse. Javier, thank you very much for joining me on the show tonight.
It was a great pleasure once again. Thank you.
As always. And thanks to the audience for listening. And we'll be back next week.
If you were asleep and have not been tuned into the documentary and political analysis of Safe Harbor, here's what you've missed.
Every voice needs to be discussed. The voice they want to hear and the voice they don't want to hear.
One of the mistakes which some political analysts make is to think that their enemies should be our enemies.
An electoral choice of 10 different fascists is like choosing which way one wishes to die.
He came, he saw, he died.
Bernie Sanders, and people are saying, no, he's the best candidate for black people. And I'm so sick of white people telling black people what's in their best interest.
I don't see race. I'm colorblind. Can you still see me as white?